I'm Celine McKay, and this is the Pure Green Podcast, episode 24. Welcome to this week's episode of the PGM Podcast. I'm so happy you're here sharing this audio space with me. This week, I'm talking with Tara O'Brady, the voice and author behind the blog and now book of the same name, Seven Spoons.
Especially with a cookbook, only half of its life is what's on the page. I feel like its greatest importance is what in the action that it inspires. I want this to be, I hope this to be a book that is stained and tattered and written all over and is actually truly useful. So in telling those stories, I hope that it adds to the usefulness of it, because then you can see yourself in that and say, I understand this. And though I've never tasted this food, I feel like I already can in a way, and I can already see how it fits in my life.
Tara is whip smart and super well spoken, and conducting this interview was, well, a real treat. A review from her book says it all. Few food writers have such an insightful, intuitive understanding of flavor, or a more eclectic and inspiring range of culinary influences at work in their kitchen than Tara O'Brady. Fewer still write with her trademark warmth and thoughtful prose, which Saver describes as like pulling up a seat at the table of an old friend. In the interview, Tara and I talk about quite a lot. My prepared interview questions were forgotten, and mostly I just let Tara take center stage. She describes how she developed her own style of cooking, gleaned from her heritage and multicultural influences, and years of practice. She speaks of cooking for her family and how to stay prepared so that putting food on the table isn't an ordeal. She speaks of real life, of how ordinary and yet extraordinary it can be. I ask her about her instincts in the kitchen, and she speaks eloquently about looking inward rather than outward at trends or social media when it comes to cooking. I especially love when she speaks of cooking using all the senses and of becoming a cook rather than learning to cook. And, of course, we talk about what it was like to launch a book to such critical acclaim. I hope you enjoy listening to Tara as much as I enjoyed talking with her. Here's Tara.
I'm so happy to have you on, Tara. I've followed you and admired you for a long time, and I'm so, so happy to see the success that you're experiencing right now. Like, that must be so surreal.
It is very surreal. I'm just absolutely floored and humbled by the response there's been. The other day I was in San Francisco at an event, and I had this moment of thinking I'm this person from not the biggest city in Southern Ontario, and that I could cross not only the continent but change countries, and that there was people in the room that wanted to talk about what I was doing in my little corner of the world. And there's something so humbling and so lovely about that, and I owe so much of that to the community online, because nothing would have happened if it hadn't been that convergence of timing and technology or any of that. So it's been wonderful, and I couldn't be happier with seeing the book in people's hands and in their houses and the stuff that they're cooking from it. So it's pretty great.
Yeah, I can only imagine. It's funny sometimes, you know, when you live your own little life and it just doesn't feel remarkable, but then to the outside looking in, you're doing something pretty spectacular.
Oh, thank you. I often say that the way that I wanted to write the book was not really about me being special in any way, because I don't think that I am. I live a pretty quiet life, but I hope that what it is that people, it's not about me setting being apart from them, but instead that they see some of themselves in it, that when I talk about days that are busy or that desire for a certain type of cooking on a certain type of mood or scheduling, that they, or if I talk about how food functions in my life, that then you're seeing yourself in that. So you say, I understand that I have those similar priorities, or I have those similar needs, or those, even those same interests. And so then I hope that then the reader feels like, I understand this. I get that. I can already see it in my life, because I see my life in the stories that you're telling. And I love the idea that there's that connection there, because I feel like, of course, food is that thing that all of us share in common. So it's really quite something. And also, and I'm sure you, and of course you know this from being part of digital media, is that with so much of it, you're just typing onto a computer screen. And even though there's responses. It's very different when you actually can be in the room with people and see them, and they're no longer avatars and screen names, but they're people with these rich and wonderful lives, and they want you to be part of it. It's really quite remarkable.
Yes, I can totally, I mean, you know what, you were very successful in what you were saying about, you know, wanting to write from a place that's genuine and real. I think that's probably why the response to your book has been so outstanding, is because that really came across. And I've been following along on your Instagram as you've been traveling, promoting your book these last little while. And it seems like you've been putting a lot of, I think you've met a lot of the people before, but you've definitely been putting a lot of faces to names. That must be very fun.
It is. And it's really almost hard to get your mind around with some of the people. A lot of the people I do know, but there are people that I've never, I guess, technically met before. And yet with so many of this, because this kind of career and this life online has now been going on for about 10 years. You know these people. You know they've gone through marriages just like I did, and children and houses and moving. So you end up with this amazing amount of backstory before you ever said hello in person. And so even though it might be the first time you're physically saying hello to them, you feel like they're already such a part of your lives, and you have all this understanding, and you already have like inside jokes and all of that.
Yeah.
So it's really quite something, because I don't know if I'd ever have any other opportunity or any other time and that you'd be able to go to a city you've never been to and yet feel like you already had a community of friends there. And that is really quite a hard thing to explain, and how welcoming that feels, and how you never feel alone in the city. And I never expected that when I set out, I think, when I set out with doing the blog, or that it would take me this far and that 10 years later I'd still be doing it.
Yeah, no kidding. And that is that is such a nice feeling. I'm happy that it's manifested in this way for you. It's so great.
Thank you.
So what's been your favorite moment of the past 10 or so, or I don't know, however long this journey started since your book came out?
It's very hard to pick one.
I can imagine. Yeah.
One of the big ones, from a very sentimental and personal point of view, was sharing it with my sons. I will say that. It's hard to explain to children all of this, really. And so, again, because the book was this thing that was on my computer, and there's so much great self-publishing out there. You can do those made by Mac books that look very official and are great. That to explain to them that it was going to be a book that other people would be able to get that are outside of our lives, that they would be in bookstores and all of that. I don't know if they got their mind around that. I don't know if I got my mind 100% around that, to be honest. But the week that the book launched, I brought my boys up to Toronto with me, and my husband was there. And one night, my older son and I kind of snuck out of the hotel and went to the big Indigo at the Eaton Centre. And so for him to see a stack of his mother's books, and he opened it up to the dedication page where his name is in there, and for him to see that outside of our town and outside of people that we knew, I think that it hit him in that way. And in so many ways, he was able to share in that, because he understood all the work that has gone on for the last basically 3 years on the book. And to see it to come to fruition was a great gift for me to be able to share that with him. And the same thing, of course, with my younger son when he was at our little launch party. I think he got up when I had a microphone in my hand and stole the show. And he now believes that he should be at all book signings because he is a part of the book, as he was a recipe tester. So I can't argue with that. Mm-hmm. So that was, from a very personal level, that was a great moment, because it's interesting when you are doing a creative endeavor like that. It is something that takes you, it's so much in your own head for so long, and it's on your shoulders, and there isn't a physicality to it for a very long time. It's a stack of papers, or it is just digital files. And so to explain that to a child or to your family, and when you're saying, I can't do that right now because mommy has to work, or mommy's staying up late to work, and those type of things, it's a long haul. And yeah. It's very isolating in some ways because it's all on your shoulders. I think a lot of people in a creative field feel that because it's not like someone else can take up the slack for you when it comes to that work. That work has to be done by you and you alone for a lot of it. And so when it comes to now, when we just get to share it and talk about it and they can see and understand and they get to see all the pictures that were stuck up on our dining room wall for a year, to see it all bound together is really quite different for them. I think it's a great legacy to them for the importance of creative work, for them to see their mother do something like that, because in so many ways, because I stay at home for most of my days, I'm their mom first and foremost, but I love that I can now give them this something that I can be a mom and I can also be a writer to them. And I hope that that will stay with them for the belief in their own dreams and what that they want to pursue as they move forward. Another thing that I loved, I will say, has been social media through all of this. It sounds really silly, but I love seeing people making things from the book. It is the best mm-hmm. thing in the world when you open up and you see them excited about their breakfast or lunch or dinner, and they're telling you how they made a dish from the book or who they made it for, because now the book isn't mine. It's out there and it has this life of its own and this usefulness that I hope that people find. And now I just get to sit back and watch and share all of that with other people. And so that's the most fun from a larger sense, because I feel like people now, when I wrote the book, I said it was my half of the conversation. Now the readers get to fill in their half of the conversation, and I can't wait to listen.
Yeah, I really love that. I mean, of all the things, you know, you've been on TV, you've been on the CBC, you've done all these really fantastic, big, big things. And I really love that what stuck out to you was, you know, those private moments with your boys and the culmination of this huge chunk of your life and time. I mean, that's just, it's priceless. And I'm glad as well that you mentioned what it was like to see your book in a major bookstore for the first time. I can only imagine. That's pretty great. And, you know, likewise, whenever I see, you know, Instagrams in particular of people who read the magazine and really love it, it's a bright spot in my day and in my life. And so I can imagine how great that feels.
It is. And don't you love that you see people's twists on things or how they might serve something differently? And then I feel like the recipe becomes all that much better for it, because again, mm-hmm. anytime that you're doing all of this type of work, collaboration, I think, just pushes it so much better, because the more perspectives you have when it comes to something that's always evolving, like food or even writing and perspective, that having all these voices in it just raises the bar of the conversation. And so I've seen things now and that people have said, oh, I put these two things together and I would never have thought of that. And then the next day, I just can't wait to get in the kitchen and try it for myself. So I think that that at this stage now, it's the readers are making the book better, and it's really fun.
Yeah, it sounds great. And I have a confession to make. I was reading through your book. I got it in the mail last week, and so I've been sort of glancing at it, but last night I really sat down and I had a really good read through it, and it was, I don't know, 11:30, almost 12, and I've been really stuck on breakfast lately. I find breakfast hard because I get up, I'm a little tired because I'm terrible at going to bed at a reasonable hour. You know, Charlie, my daughter, is up and she's a little cranky and I'm worried about getting out of the door and, you know, on time. So breakfast is just uninspired for me. Mm-hmm. When I saw your recipe for the chia pudding, and I loved the interpretation of it, and I almost got up to prepare it. I didn't, but I almost did. I had to talk myself out of it. So,
well, it's very fast and it's very easy. And yeah. I'm a big believer in kind of setting ourselves up for success the next day. I often use the cobbler and the elves analogy in saying, you put a little work in overnight and then it feels like magic has taken place in your kitchen over it by the time it's morning. And the same thing I feel about the no need bread recipe that I do, because it is literally bowl and spoon. And yet the next morning there's just like a little padding and folding and you have bread. And mm-hmm. the same thing with the chia pudding or the turmeric honey that I put alongside that. If you keep a jar of that in your fridge And you can turn it in, you can again have it on yogurt or granola, but then you can turn it, if someone's sick, have boil water, mm-hmm. and then stir it in like a tea. And it makes this great drink because the ginger in it helps clear everything out. And you've got a little bit of pepper for, which is supposed to help in circulation. And of course, the turmeric is so good for the digestive system and anti-inflammatory and all of that. And, or you can make it into a thing called golden milk. It's an Ayurvedic recipe. And you do the same thing, but with warm milk. So you feel like you've got a little bottle of goodness in the fridge all set up for you. And it takes maybe 5 minutes to make, because it's a case of stirring all those ingredients into honey and that's it.
Yeah.
So I love doing that because then the next morning you just open up your fridge and breakfast is already done for you.
Yeah, that's a great, I love those tips. That's a really great idea. I don't know why I didn't really think to make the honey ahead, like a larger batch and keep it, but that's genius. And absolutely. And, you know, I'm getting better with planning ahead.
Mm-hmm. It's hard.
And, you know, I'm just one of those people, I find that I'm a little too reactive. I think a lot of us are. And working on becoming proactive, it feels so great, but it's so hard to do, which is really odd.
I totally agree in that. Why, and I think it's the snacks section, the section with snacks, and also in the pantry, you'll see that I talk about always being prepared because I was never a person that, because I'm very an emotional cook and an emotional eater. I'm very bad at meal planning because I will say, okay, on Thursday we're having chicken, and then Thursday happens and I don't want chicken.
Yeah.
And then what do I do? So I found what worked for me instead was, again, stocking myself up so that it's like my Swiss Army knife of all my tricks and good and my goodies. So for me, I figured out that that was cans of chickpeas, because if there's chickpeas in the house, I feel like I can make something, whether it is hummus or there is a salmon with butter beans in the book, but I sometimes do that with chickpeas as well. You know, you can always make chana masala, or you can make a chickpea soup pretty easily. Truthfully, chickpea sautéed with a bit of the harissa in the book and with a fried egg. I'll call that dinner quite happily. So that's what I started doing, was really trying to figure out what are the things that I can do a lot of stuff with. And so that's the harissa. That's why so much of the pantry are things that store really well. So it's like a jar of the harissa in the fridge, the honey in the fridge. Also, I'll sometimes make a big batch of the different salad dressings. There's a miso tahini one, which has a lot of orange juice in it, which I adore, and works well with kale, with apples, with all manner of grain salads. So again, I feel like I can just toss bunches of things into a bowl, drizzle on some of that dressing, and there's a meal for me. So that was how I handle it. Like, I'm not good at planning ahead, but this way, if I have these little things, it's amazing what a little bit of sauce can do to take a little bit of leftovers or something really basic and turn it into something exceptional. So that's kind of how I have tackled that problem.
Oh, that's a genius way of doing it, though. Because like you, I can totally identify, you know, with the meal planning thing. We've got our meals all planned out for the week, and, you know, and then you're like,
Yeah.
And so that's a great way of doing it, because you're planning, you're setting yourself up for success, like you said, but you're not tying yourself down.
It allows for the improv, and I love a little bit of improvisation. Another one is the lentil koftas that are in the book. In it, the book, there is a, they're done in a curry. They're turned into a lentil kofta curry. But I make the koftas themselves don't cook in the curry. They're baked off beforehand because they're so tender that they will fall apart in the curry if you leave them too long. So they're basically falafels, but done with French lentils. So I make a big batch of those, freeze them on the baking sheet, and then stick them in the freezer. And you can use them just as you would falafels. So again, if I have the hummus from the book in the fridge, I have a little thing of greens or a little bit of that miso tahini dressing that I love. You pop those little balls either on a plate and just dunk them with a bunch of crunchy vegetables. That's often what I give my kids after school. Or I pop it into a naan and then throw on a bunch of sprouts, and there's a meal. So again, I love, there's a lot of notes in the book about doubling up recipes, how you can store them and then use them in different ways. Again, it totally appeals to my emotional eating when I have options. I'm good. I like options.
Yes.
And you never know what your schedule is going to bring. That's the other problem, is that I feel like our days are so changing that one day is rarely identical to the next. So it's really hard sometimes to anticipate, let's say on a Sunday, what's going to happen next Friday and what your needs are going to be. So if you have your little bag of tricks all at the ready, it makes me feel that much more prepared.
I love all that. That's really, really great advice. And, you know, I know that the subtitle of your book is, you know, your favorite recipes for any and every day. But listening to you talk about it, I know that that's not just a subtitle. That's the truth.
It is.
because you're talking about these recipes like they feature in your everyday life, which is great. And you mean you're not tired of them after staring at them and laboring over them for all this time. It's great.
It is very true. When I was putting together the recipe list for the proposal, my husband read it and he was a little surprised because he said, none of this is new. And they are new to readers because less than 10% of what's in the book has ever appeared in publications anywhere else. So that is between my site and all of my freelance work. That's less than 14 recipes out of 114 are, I think we're at like 10 recipes maybe, have appeared elsewhere. And those were because they were tried and true and absolute favorites that I felt like needed to be there, like the peanut butter cookies, which are my family's standard. But everything else were just our family favorites that I've never had the opportunity to share. And it was my excuse to hone those down and really get them to where I felt that they had, they were as concise as they could be, because often these were recipes I'd never written down, but they were things that I just made, out of instinct for so many years. And then, so it really was, I'm still cooking from the book. I now have my actual hard copy of it, but I am cooking from it. And it was great when I was doing so many demos over the last couple of weeks, because I was loving the chance to cook that food again, because especially when I was traveling, it was like my utter comfort food, because I was making my gochujang fried chicken, or I was, the other day, we did do the hummus with white miso, tahini, and white miso is one of my favorite combinations, so it appears in the book multiple times. But when we had that hummus, and I was in Seattle on a lunch, and we did the hummus and the chicken salad that is with za'atar, roasted vegetables, and then bitter greens, and then the coconut kheer, but we paired it with the pickled strawberries from the book instead of the pineapple as it's featured there. And it felt like home, and I was on the other side of the continent, and yet it was flavors that I literally and quite truly crave. So, I hope that because they are so tested and have such a long history with us, that people then really do feel like they can believe in the recipes and that they can believe what I'm saying when I say I truly love them.
Yeah, that... It's amazing the ability that food has to just make us feel like home. You know, it has all of the, you know, the things that evoke comfort and, you know, and good memories. It's amazing how food can do that.
I think it was Nigella Lawson. I know it was Nigella Lawson, but I think it was possibly a Nigella Bites. And I'm paraphrasing from memory here, but she said something to the effect that food was where social history and gossip meet. And I loved that. And I remember it resonating with me at the time, because I think about how food tells us so much about ourselves as a people. You can see the economic world in what we're eating. You can see political worlds when you think about, if you go through the cultural history of any country and you see times of domination when different influences were coming in. You also see dietary concerns as you see shifts. If you think about through the 80s when fat was bad and margarine was king, and stuff like, and you see all of these changes. So in our, and you also see our priorities when you're talking about really luxurious meals versus really maybe quick meals. When we look at all of this and you put it into that context, the anthropology of it is amazing. And I've always been really fascinated by that, and what our food was telling us about where we are and what was important to us. And so that played a huge part in the book. And that is why when I was looking at it, that it ended up having this really kind of diverse, without even thinking about it, diverse breadth of subject matter as well as style of cooking. There are recipes that take 10 minutes, like the burger with is really, really fast. Or, of course, there's a recipe for scrambled eggs, which is can be quicker. But then you have things that are for like a Sunday afternoon when you really want some time. And then you have whole grain recipes, and then you have cakes full of. And because, again, I feel like right now we're in this really interesting place when it comes to food, where we have the ability to pull from so many different influences, so many great techniques, ingredients, and all of that. And how do you get all of that into one idea of food and one book about food? So I find that I bounced around a lot when it came to it. But in the end, I feel like a lot of people are responding to that in a wonderful way, because it reflects how a lot of us are living these days.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you in the on the inside cover of your book, I'm not sure who wrote it actually, but there's a little blurb that it seems like it was written by somebody else, and they talk about the eclectic and inspiring range of culinary influences in the kitchen. And so I was curious to ask you, you know, you just kind of briefly touched on it there, but who do you look up to or are influenced to by the most?
When it comes to food writing or in my own kitchen?
In your own kitchen, with cooking, like creating recipes.
I don't know if there's a person that I can say one thing. It comes from so many places. It comes from, of course, the fact that my own heritage, I will say, because my mother traveled a lot before her marriage, and then she married a ship's captain, so continued to travel. And because of that, my parents combined had a very broad range of like influences and loves. And because of that, they never made us feel like anything, whether it be who we married or what we could do in life or what we ate, was off limits, because they had seen such a range of it in their own experience. So as much as my mom was making really traditional Indian food, she was reading magazines in the 80s and making cheesecake and panko crusted chicken wings. And so I never really put lines down of what was our food and what was someone else's food. And I didn't realize, I don't think, until I started writing the book and when people started calling it eclectic or any of that, that I realized that that wasn't always the norm for people. And it's also what I think allowed me to feel that accessibility, and that I was allowed to be this enthusiastic participant in cultures and in traditions that weren't my own. And so that was a big thing for me. The other thing, of course, was also my husband's heritage and also the relationship with food there, because my husband's an only child and he comes from Irish and British background, but his family's been in Canada for a very long time. And because of the fact that his culinary history was so different than mine, that I wanted our kids to know that in a very real way in our home, and that their food wasn't something, just like with my side of the family, I didn't want Indian food to just be something they had with their grandparents. I didn't want butter tarts to be something that was just with their grandparents on the other side, whereas I never grew up eating or making butter tarts, and yet his family, they're a great tradition. So I found myself taking on a lot of their recipes and really wanting to understand and know them so that I could pass on that to my children. That food is admittedly the thing I'm good at. And so to give my kids a sense of who they are and where they kind of fit in the world, then it came through food. And so I was learning that. And again, I fell in love with so much of it. My husband taught in Korea, and I wasn't with him on that trip or part of that. But in me trying to be supportive of that time and wanting to learn more about Korean food, I'm the one who's now addicted to kimchi. And I'm really excited about making my own. So those are just very pragmatic in some ways things that informed my food. And then, of course, I have a strong affection for British food writing. I think, again, because there's such multiculturalism that happens in Europe, and that you read books, again, let's say like Nigel Slater and Nigella Lawson, they move around so much in the types of foods that they have in the books. And it's not mentioned as being remarkable or being special. It's just, again, reflecting the way that they eat. And one of my favorite columns is Felicity Cloakes in The Guardian. She gets into recipes and compares and contrasts them and talks about what works and what doesn't. And that really is fascinating to me and appeals to like my academic mind. I love Yoram Ottolenghi's recipes, the ways that he puts together flavors River Cottage, their series of books are so wonderful. I think that they make me look at ingredients in new ways. And I love how they're like simple, simple ingredients just treated really, really well. So I would say that whole canon of food writing is very inspirational to me. It also, I will admit, a level of nostalgia. My maternal grandmother was Anglo-Indian, and so the way that they talk in those books reminds me of the way that she talked, so I can hear her voice in them, and I think she'd approve.
Wow. I mean, what a fantastic answer. You actually did a really beautiful job of answering another question that I had, which was about the international flair that really shows through in the book. There's lots of influences like you're talking about that kind of come together to create your own genre, kind of. And so you did a really great job of speaking to that. So you speak fondly in the book of your childhood, specifically as it relates to food. So what role did food play in your household growing up, and how did it influence how you think about food today?
Well, I will say I came from a family of cooks and a family of eaters. That made it very easy. So because my dad was a ship's captain, he was away quite a bit. And my mom was home, and her mother would stay with us quite often. So they were in the kitchen and cooking because that was the only way they knew how to do things. It was when it came to our food, because Indian food in Indian restaurants, of course, was not as big then. I remember them having to drive to go get Indian rice, and it took them about an hour and a half round trip, and they would go every couple of weeks to stock up on big bags of rice and dal. And things like cilantro was not something you could get in the grocery store, our grocery store then. We had to go to a specialty store for it. So to have those foods in our home, it took commitment and took time, and it wasn't a big deal. It just became part of our routines. And so the trip to the Indian store, as we called it, because it was the Indian store, the one that we had available to us at the time, was just a given. And the same thing, it happened to be from cooking from scratch. And the case was also the same with our next door neighbors. They were Italian, and the mother was from Calabria. And the same thing. So I was watching Liliana put up peppers in the summertime, and Fabio was making wine in the basement. And come Easter, they were making sweet breads in the shape of purses for all us little girls. And again, all of these traditions and this idea of family and these routines of our day revolved around food. And also, when you travel a lot, which we did because we traveled to go see my father on the ship, so we traveled back to India, food was that one constant. When your environments are so different and the people you're even with in some ways besides your immediate family can change so much, what is the thing that you can take with you is food. And so it was, to me, the little packed lunches my mom would make for train rides in India and specific flavors that made us feel a little bit familiar. I remember eating a burger that was very similar to a Big Mac, but made with lamb in New Delhi after being in India for quite some time, and it tasted like home to me. I love Indian food, but the idea of just having this burger after a few months away felt so familiar and so comforting, and felt like a little bit of the things that I was missing at the time. And it's amazing what all that can do. So food was always, it just happened to be something that we held on to, and it was something that we all really shared. And so that, I think, again, it doesn't mean that it was something that was like ceremonial in a really big, fancy way. It didn't mean that every meal took hours to make, but I think it added to the sense of being thoughtful about our food, and that even if you're going to have something that's really simple, like I love that the book cover is a piece of toast, but if you're going to have toast, why not make it great toast? If you think about the difference, let's say like a banh mi, if you have a banh mi on that great bread that you always think of, that French baguette style bread, but then if you put that same filling on a hamburger bun, it changes the sandwich completely. And it doesn't take a lot of time to cut a baguette versus cutting a hamburger bun, but that little thoughtful choice makes all the difference in the world. And I feel like I got that from my parents and got that from my mother, and the idea that if you were going to do something, just put that little extra thoughtfulness into it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how I often hear people talk about how there's very little time or room in life to live your life this way. But really, when the rhythm of your family kind of pulsates around the kitchen, and it's what brings you together, it's what creates the memories, and it also is what sustains you all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems effortless and pleasant.
Well, so, yeah, that's a big thing for me, because let's be honest, I have all of those real commitments. I don't have a studio kitchen. I cook in my own home. And I have two kids who are very busy, and I have to, I'm volunteering at the school, and then they have classes, and we have family, and we have friends, and I have the reality of laundry that needs to be done, and counters that need a wipe down, and oh, the garden needs weeding. There are all of that happening in my life. So it isn't always this beautiful thing where I'm just going to luxuriate as I walk through the market in this bucolic setting and I look fantastic and my hair is perfect. That doesn't happen. Let's be real about that. But when we talk about our days and you think about someone, let's say, putting 10 minutes or 15 minutes or an hour into getting dressed in the morning, we take that as a given. Because we've decided that doing your hair a certain way or getting in that extra run before work is a priority for us. And the first time you might do it, that you say that you're going for a run, it might seem like a big deal, but you do it for a couple months and you set it, it feels almost like there's an extra hour in the day because you can't imagine your days without that run. And I think of cooking that way. When it is just part entrenched into our rhythms, first of all, it becomes easier. Because you start up a habit of it, and I think that habits can be good habits, not just things that we want to break. When you get into the habit of it, you stop thinking about it. And so if it is that 5 extra minutes of saying, oh, I'm going to whisk together this dressing now because I have 5 minutes, and then it's in a jar in the fridge, and it's ready for me come lunchtime, you're already ahead of the game. And it is figuring out how to stock your pantry and stock your refrigerator in such a way that you're able to throw together a meal in 10 minutes or even less when you're on your way out the door later. It's those things only happen by doing. And it is in so many ways that if we set it aside as it has to be this big deal thing that that is so separate from everything else we're doing. So it's we're shopping only for that meal and we are putting everything out in this like very structured way, that then it becomes like a chore rather than just an extension of what we're already doing. So for me, that is the, that while I'm getting my kids in the, ready for school in the morning, it's me taking a look in the fridge. So saying, what do I need for tonight? So after I drop them off for school, it's a quick trip to the market. And it's not taking an hour, it's taking 15 minutes because I just took that moment to look in the fridge and see what was there and see how I can build off of that. So in so many ways, that's what I was trying to do with the book, was trying to convey in some way how all these wonderful habits, these good habits that I've picked up over 10 years of cooking and passed them on to the reader. I call it my cheat sheet or my like when you miss biology and you ask your friends for their notes, that's what I want the cookbook to be, that it gives you the culmination and all the benefit of all these years that I've spent in the kitchen.
Yeah, I mean, as I said before, you really did accomplish that in the book, absolutely. I mean, you write in a beautiful style, both on your blog and in your book, and I found that it really blends the learned wisdom with the truisms of daily life. I mean, you make no bones about that, but you still make it seem, you know, so beautiful and inspirational at the same time. So, you know, I think all of that messiness of real life is just wrapped up in the smells wafting from the kitchen. That's what I imagine in your house.
Well, one of the reasons I think that happened is because, and I thank you for that compliment first and foremost, but people sometimes do say to me that they feel that their writing is sensory and that you do get this wonderful picture. And in some ways, that came out of a very pragmatic thing. And that is that I write in a sensory way because I want you to be thinking about your senses the whole time. A recipe can only take you so far. The missing piece of that puzzle between a successful recipe and one that fails is you as a cook. I'm not in your kitchen. And so it is paying attention to what's going on in the pan, starting to notice how butter smells as it starts to brown. Or you can tell a cake is done by how it smells in your oven without even looking at it. You'll start smelling that toasted quality. You'll start smelling when you can smell browning, which sounds really funny, but it's that caramel note of sugar starting to brown. And the same thing with proteins. It's a very sweet smell, and it doesn't happen until a cake is actually cooked. And so starting to pay attention to something little like that makes you a better cook, not just somebody that can read a recipe. And so I fill my recipes with that type of stuff. Timing will only take you so far, but one day, a dough for a cake, for bread will rise way faster than another. And it may be due to humidity. It may be due to that batch of yeast. It could be due to the sugar that day. There's all these different factors that I can't anticipate at writing a recipe. So, but if I talk to you about what a ball of dough looks like when it's properly proved, then you can figure that out. And and then hopefully then the next time you make a different recipe, even if it's not one of mine, you have those skills already kind of, and those sensory cues built into your mind. So you can then take that and what I said and take that framework and put it on so many other things. And again, makes you all the better for it, because that's really what I want people to come away with. Not that they, that it's just about me and my recipes, but it's about you and what you take away from it.
Yes, I love that. And it's reminded me of a part in your introduction where I actually had a huge smile on my face as I was reading this, because you know, you're reading where you talk about learning to cook your way and of the, to use your words, the culinary witchcraft that allows a true cook to whip up something delicious from seemingly nothing. And those skills that you're talking about, you know, like not needing the timer, just going by feel and by smell and all of those things. I mean, it does feel a little witchy because it's just this learned thing. Mm-hmm. It reminds me of this, you'll probably laugh, but it reminds me of Julia Child. Like, I feel like she and you have that in common. You know, as you wrote, you didn't learn to cook, you became a cook.
Mm-hmm.
So can you sort of, what was the progression of that like? Like, what do you remember most fondly, and what wisdom would you pass along to someone who's just starting out in their cooking journey?
Well, the blog started out there. I knew how to cook. I already knew basics of cooking. I started cooking in my teens, like late, I would say before, like maybe 8 or 9, I started doing some baking and then doing more through my teenage years. I started with baking, I think, because my mom was a great baker, but didn't do a lot of it. So if I baked, it was my special thing that I could do. And I never felt that I was comparing myself. Because the one problem when you grow up with really capable cooks in your house is that you never feel that yours is as good as theirs. So if I baked, it was, this is mine alone in a lot of ways. So I knew how to cook when I started the blog. But the thing was, I was cooking on special occasions, or when I was trying to impress my boyfriend, or as a gift for someone. So these are really isolated things. But what did it mean to be the cook that could come home after work and could make something on a real regular basis? And so I had no idea that repertoire of those go-to recipes that are in your back pocket all the time and you can whip up in a flash. I did not have those. And so the blog was that for me at the beginning. The first part of the blog was very much my account of what was working for me, what wasn't working for me, and it happened to coincide with the time that blog technology allowed for that. Or let's say 2 years earlier, or maybe 5 years earlier, it would have been in a notebook. But it just so wonderfully coincided with that rise of blog. So that's what it was. And if you look at my early blog posts, a lot of them are about trend, because I didn't know who I was when it came to cooking. I didn't know my flavors as to what was going to be what felt like me. And especially at that time, I was really trying to blend my husband Sean's taste, who was my boyfriend at the time, his taste and the flavors he loved with what I liked. Like, he was a guy who didn't like onions, which is the start of every curry. And I hated mushrooms, which is his absolute favorite thing, that if you put that into a recipe, he would order it on a restaurant menu. And I hated them so much. And I now love mushrooms, because my childhood experience with mushrooms is very much like canned mushrooms, or mushrooms, like flabby mushrooms on pizzas. So I had a bad introduction to it. So I was doing a lot of restaurant things, things I had seen in a restaurant or eaten in a restaurant and then trying to do. So they ended up being in some ways a little bit more complicated, or I felt they had to be fancy because I was looking outward a lot at that time. You know, it's that thing where the first time you get to try on makeup, you put on what you saw in a magazine, and it may not be the right thing for you, that you're trying like frosted eyeshadow because that's what's trendy, or really strong contouring because you saw that, and then the next day you're trying something completely different because you're not sure what suits you yet. And so it's a lot of trial and error in the start, I feel like. No one is born a great cook. You may have certain cooking instincts, but all of it comes through time. You can't, it's again, to bounce around in my analogy, it's like musicians, you have to learn the scales before you can improvise. And so you have to practice those scales, and then maybe you try acoustic for a while, and then you move on to electric guitar, and then you try, next thing you do, you're a folk guitarist, until you settle into what is your sound. Same thing with food. It takes a while to settle into what is your food, and that is those tastes you keep coming back to, the style of cooking that suits your everyday. So the biggest thing I could tell a person starting out is learn to trust your own instincts. Figure out what tastes good to you. Because once again, I'm not in your kitchen. No writer is. So it has to appeal to you and make you feel happy and satisfied and fulfilled at the end of the day. If a magazine tells you that you have to do it this way, but you say, you know what, I really like it this way, then be okay with the way that you like it. It doesn't have to look like anything else. It doesn't have to taste like anything else because it's supposed to be about you. And that is, it takes a little while to find that confidence, I feel like, but allow yourself that time with it as well. Because when it comes to food, whoever you're cooking for, whether it be you or your family, if it's done with love and a little bit of thoughtfulness, they will appreciate it. And it's just food. It's not, it doesn't have to be something that we stress ourselves about or worry about. There are days when I'm giving my kids eggs for dinner because that's all I can manage to get on the table. And they're pretty happy with that when I say it's breakfast for dinner night. And it's not something that takes a lot. So I think it's in a lot of ways, it's being okay with being yourself in the kitchen and trusting your tastes and your instincts and what feels good and right to you, and allowing you that time to make mistakes. I will always remember the day that I thought I would make cinnamon buns to, again, impress my boyfriend's parents on Christmas morning, and I killed the yeast somehow. So we did not have cinnamon buns that day. And I have many scars and burns on my forearms from cooking mistakes and mishaps from those days. And I'm good with that because I feel like that I've learned so much from all of those experiences. So allow yourself the time to kind of learn as well.
Oh, that's so, I love all of that, what you said. And I especially loved what you said about looking inward instead of outward. I think that that's true of a lot of things in life. But it's, again, it's one of those things that's, it's almost not how we're wired to do things, kind of, you know, to have that confidence. And you talk about that intuitiveness, and it's almost like, you know, with successful food writers like yourself, you imagine it as being a sixth sense that you just, there's no hope of you ever, you know, possessing that. But you're saying it just comes from time, from experience.
Okay.
And so that's very, it's real and achievable. It's just about putting in the time, which I love.
And it,
so thank you for that.
Well, it's so true. Because it's like anything that, and pick a skill set that whatever you're good at. For example, I am not a marathon runner at all, nowhere near it. And yet I have good friends that are distance runners and endurance athletes. And to them, if I say, how do you get through that many kilometers of running? They can't think of how they do it because now they've run so many times that is they don't think about it anymore. And they just get to the point where it feels good and feels right to them. But I'm sure that at whatever age that they started, the first time they tried to tackle that distance, it seemed insurmountable. And we somehow assume that cooking is going to be different from that, or anything, whether it can be writing or whether it be balancing a budget. The first time you do it will seem hard. Mm-hmm. And but that doesn't mean that it's impossible. And it's often just about breaking it down. And again, with the recipes in the book, that's one of the reasons why I try to talk so much about like why I get into a ridiculous treatise, and I hope I say ridiculous in an affectionate way. there's a treatise on the shape of butter and how the shape of butter will affect your biscuit or your pastry dough, that round butter versus shingled flat pieces of butter, how that will change the structure of your dough. And the reason I get into that is because I feel like if you understand what's going on with your cooking, then again, you're able to apply that so many other places. So breaking it down to the small details sometimes makes the overall picture seem that much more easy and possible. So with a runner, you might be saying, if I get through 1 mile or 1 kilometer, then I'm already halfway to the next. And that's true. You know, you break it down into small steps. And then next thing you know, you've run for hours. The same thing with cooking. If I break it down to small steps and I tell you about what's happening with butter or how the folding technique, let's keep with the biscuits. If I tell you about how the folding technique that I use builds up strata and layers of butter and flour and how that will give you rise and puff. And then the next thing you know, I'm talking to you a little bit about spacing them on the pan different ways and what that will do to cooking. These little things that you're taking away will hopefully slowly build up a library of knowledge. And next thing you know how to cook.
It boils back down to what you said before about cooking with all of your senses and being observant. And, you know, it's like, it's called trial and error for a reason. And it's as long as you can learn from that, then you're good.
It is. It's the trial part that I think that we forget about. And again, it's not, it doesn't have to be very, very rigid or formal in those trials. It is that time it takes to figure out how long is your perfect boiled egg. Do you like it runnier? Or my two boys like their eggs vastly different. And so it took a little while of timing and figuring out whose perfect egg was what. And now I can do it without thinking. And that takes a bit. And we have to allow ourselves that. One of the things, I love social media in so many ways, but in some ways that it makes us really aware of the visuals of it all. And the idea of, and again, it's that looking outwards versus looking in, where you're saying it has to be perfect and has to be beautiful and it has to look effortless. But the things that are really worthwhile in life, they take a little work. And do you not feel that when you pushed yourself through something and you're looking back on the other side, that feels like such more of an achievement than if you coasted the whole way? Those are the lessons that stick with us, are the ones that we really worked for. And so with cooking, to me, that is it, that the chocolate chip cookies in the book, we had a running tally on our fridge for a year and a half, I think it was, of how many cookies I had baked, because I thought if I'm doing a chocolate chip cookie recipe, I really wanted it to be something that was really exceptional, and also that it was worthy of adding to the conversation because there's so many great recipes out there. So I think our number, we had over 700, and I say we because my family had to carry this. I'm not talking about it in the royal we sense. I mean because my family had to deal with me doing this. We had over 700 cookies.
I'm sure that was really hard for them.
They got to a point they were kind of sick of cookies. I was giving,
really?
Yeah.
That's possible.
700 cookies is a lot of cookies.
Yeah, over how long?
About a year and a half.
Yeah.
And so I was baking cookies so much. I was sending little balls of dough, frozen balls of dough, Ziploc bags of them to all of our family and friends. And kept every bake sale, I was giving cookies. Well, I will give you so many cookies because I would bake just 12 from every batch, and an early version of it's 28 cookies per batch, but an early version of it was about 40 cookies per batch. Yeah, so I would bake 12 and the rest would be balled up in my freezer. So my freezer was just stacks and stacks of cookies, comparing different cooking times, different amounts of sugar. And then once I felt like I got my recipe, just testing. So that took a lot of tries, like that was a lot of butter, sugar, flour, chocolate to go through over that time. And it was, so I really tested that into the ground. And at the end of it, that is the recipe that I am so proud of. And when people make it and I see it, or that I get to see somebody the first time they have that cookie, that to me is my touchdown dance.
And it means so much to me because I feel like I lived every, and I know that recipe inside out and have literally spent so much time with it that I feel like I worked really hard for it. And so the same thing with, I think, any cooking. When you feel like you have really, you made yourself a really delicious whatever. And again, it could be as simple as a piece of toast, but when it's the exact way you wanted it to be, that is so rewarding. And so sometimes though, it does take that little bit of work for a great reward. It doesn't have to be hard work, but it's work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, tonight I'm going to go make those cookies.
Because
now I have to try them.
They are, and this is, again, why I love them so. They're half an hour to make from start to finish. I'm talking idea to having a cookie in your hand half an hour.
Wow. Okay.
All it is bowl and spoon, no creaming, no mixers involved. You do not even have to bring your ingredients to room temperature. It's a melted butter cookie, so the warmth of the butter will warm up your eggs from the fridge. So it's no planning in ahead. It is quite truly. And while the butter is melting, I tell you in the instructions, that's when I chop the chocolate because I use bar chocolate rather than chocolate chips because I feel it oozes more and I like an ooze in my cookie.
Yeah.
So it's full of those little tricks to say this is how you can get your time down. So while the butter is melting, you're chopping the chocolate. It's not a difficult thing to keep track of both those things at once. And then it's just dump things in a bowl and stir. And you have cookies.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
I mean, what you're saying, it's all so inspiring. And it reminds me of, you know, I am by no means, I'm not like, well, it's probably because I haven't put the time in, but, you know, my husband is the one who cooks. He's the food editor for the magazine. He's the one who whips things up from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I did not come to the table with any cooking skills, but I think it boiled down to patience. And that was a huge turning point in my ability to cook things was the minute I stopped running around trying to do five things at once and just stood there in front of the stove and watched what I was cooking, it made a huge difference.
It is. So, and and so much of it is you. And it's what you're paying attention to and you're bringing to it. I often use the word of thoughtfulness to it, but it's, one of the things that I learned was when I started writing about food, I paid attention to food more. And when I wrote about food, because you have to articulate what's not only going on from a technical point of view, but also all these sensory things, I started understanding food in a totally different way. I said before that I felt like when I started learning the role of acid in food, whether that be vinegar or lemon juice or anything, as not as an ingredient, but as a seasoning, my food became better. So thinking instead of like a lemon tart, but thinking about like a spritz of lemon or a lot of Indian cooking, there's always fresh limes on the table. Or if you think about Mexican food and you have a taco and you squeeze that little bit of fresh lime on right at the end, what a difference that makes. But I never would have stopped and thought about that if it wasn't that I had to write about it. So writing allowed me to start, I feel like made me a better cook because I was paying attention to it. So as a cook, when you start going, what actually is going on here? Why is this delicious to me? Or why is this not tasty to me at all? It is those questions that you start asking yourself and you're thinking of. And again, it just starts a conversation about food and this repository of memories about food that then informs everything that you do going forward. So it may be that you're saying, I love this dish that I had from a restaurant, or I love this thing that my mom or dad or somebody used to make for me. And when you think about what made that delicious, what made that memorable, why do I crave that? Is it the combination of flavors? Is it the texture of it? You then can apply that to all of your cooking. But it takes you doing that. A recipe book can't tell you that.
Yes, absolutely. Definitely by writing about something, you have to break it down and you have to be so much more thoughtful and pay attention, like you've said. It's a skill, absolutely. And in terms of your writing, you know, you do more than just pay attention and write good recipes. I mean, you weave a story around what you're writing and cooking as well. So where did this just develop naturally for you, or do you have a background in writing?
I have a background in writing. Writing was always my first love. My grandmother was an English teacher and so instilled in me in a very young age a love of words. And to me, food was always the bottomless subject. It was the thing that I could always talk about. It was something that I knew that I'd always, there's always something new to learn when it comes to food. I will never know everything. And so I felt like it was something that I could, of course, always just be pursuing and learning more and taking it in and talking about it. There's always going to be a conversation about food. And the narrative side of it, I love the idea of place and perspective with food. So you start understanding what has, why are these decisions made? And whether that be from a tradition perspective, and that's when I'm talking about the North Indian egg curry, for example, is in the book, is an absolute bastardization of a Punjabi egg curry. And the Punjabi egg curry is done with hard-boiled eggs, but I did mine with, I poached the eggs actually in the curry gravy because I love a oozy yolk, and you won't get that from a hard-boiled egg. But I wanted to talk about the tradition of that curry. So sometimes that's where the narrative's from. Sometimes, again, that I talk about things like those concerns of day-to-day and being busy and when you cannot stand the thought of turning on an oven, and so what do you cook? Or sometimes it's coming up with me talking about the environment in which I live and where ingredients came from, because I feel like when we have a greater context to food, that as a reader, that I know when I read that and I see that, I'm again starting to superimpose that idea onto my own life and seeing how it fits. Because especially with a cookbook, only half of its life is what's on the page. I feel like its greatest importance is what in the action that it inspires. I want this to be, I hope this to be a book that is stained and tattered and written all over and is actually truly useful. So in telling those stories, I hope that it adds to the usefulness of it, because then you can see yourself in that and say, I understand this. And though I've never tasted this food, I feel like I already can in a way, and I can already see how it fits in my life.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we must be somehow psychically connected or something, because you keep speaking to all the things I wanted to know more about. And I love that. It's great. So, you know, I definitely noticed, I loved that line when you wrote about, you know, cooking, a cookbook is only half on the page and half the action it inspires. I mean, I am inspired in spades. I mean, just by not just by the food, but by the writing, which is why I asked you about it. I mean, it's personable, and it reads in such a way that you're both authority and friend. And that's it's a very fine balance, and you achieved it brilliantly.
Oh, thank you. I feel like I understand that with food, it's such a personal thing in so many ways. And to understand where the inspiration is coming from, I feel like we respond to context as readers, and I really wanted it to be, I said it before, that conversation, and this is my half, that if we were standing hip to hip, you know, prepping a bunch of carrots or potatoes, what do you talk about with your friend when you're doing that? You talk about your life. You talk about how you came across this recipe. You tell them, oh, by the way, you know, my mom always started her mashed potatoes in cold water, or whatever, that you bring all of this history to that conversation you're having with that person at the time. So I wanted the book to feel like that, so that I was making, I wanted people to feel that I was in the kitchen with them, and mm-hmm. that you had company through it. and again, that I hope that just enriches your experience of reading the book and hopefully cooking from the book, because I know that if you aren't a truly accomplished cook, that it can be scary to try a new technique, or let's say tackle a cuisine that you've never had a familiarity with. And so I hoped that that would be that pull through the whole thing, was that was my voice. And that if you are trying that something that feels daunting to you, then you have my voice of reassurance. And then if you're having something that maybe is absolutely familiar to you, that again, my voice is there as the camaraderie part of it. So there's always company in the kitchen, and I love that feeling when I read the people that I love, and I hope to capture a little bit of that for my readers as well.
Well, I think it's fair to say that you did. So this book then, you know, it's a really fantastic, I don't want to say culmination, because that sounds like it's the end, but just a result of all these years of writing and experimenting and learning. So where do you see yourself going from here?
Well, I do. I won't say that I think culmination is bad in some ways, because the reason it's called Seven Spoons is not actually for the website. I didn't go into it calling it Seven Spoons, if you want to know the truth on that. Seven Spoons mm-hmm. is called that because I wanted it to be the collection of 10 years of experience. The site turned 10 years old on May 1st, and the book came out on April 21st. Mm. And that decade was the most changing decade of my life as a cook. It went from being a professional who worked outside of the home and worked 9 to 5, and what all the priorities that came with that, and also the budget that came with that of two working professionals in a home, well, to get really down to the nitty gritty of it. So that was time and different finances and all of that, to being a wife, to being pregnant and having cravings of things I loved and things I hated, to being a mom who had another voice at the table, and then do that twice over. So I now have children with opinions on what they want to eat. And the idea of heritage and passing on I say that the first couple of years of the blog was me figuring out my food personality and figuring out my food. And then the next few years of the blog was me applying that to a very changing real life. Because you can have a theory, but then it never is proven until it's tested, right? Mm-hmm. And so those years of experience and living with these recipes and living with this food and this idea of what I thought my food was going to be, I needed those years of actually testing it and to actually prove to me whether or not it was going to stick. So Seven Spoons, the book, as being a collection of those 10 years, I'm good with that. And that's why in the end I was really happy that we went with the title that we did, because it was a nod to the site that made all of this happen. But to me, on a very personal level, it is the recognition of all that I learned in those 10 years, because that's one of the reasons why I wouldn't, I was first approached to do a book 5 years ago, and that's one of the reasons why I didn't, was because I still felt like I was in that testing phase, and that, and I'm kind of personally proud of being 10 years into it and being able to look back on those lessons. And then moving forward, truthfully, I would love to continue what I'm doing. I feel so very lucky to be the position I am in, where people seem to enjoy my food and enjoy what I have to say. So I would love to continue doing that. I have had the opportunity recently to teach a bit of cooking, and that's my favorite part of the day. I've done a few different workshops, and some have been more on the writing and photography side of things, but my favorite part of those days has always been when we break for lunch and everyone's around the table and we're making food together and we're talking about food, and it's the active side of it rather than the theory side of it. So anytime I can get my hands dirty, I'm really, really happy. And now that that the book is out and I get to have this back and forth with people, that it's not just mm-hmm. me putting out this stuff into the ether, that it's coming back to me better than I sent it out, is the most amazing thing. And so I would love to continue working with people and being able to write more and continue what I'm doing.
Yeah, well, seriously, I'm so inspired by you, Tara.
I'm honored by that. Thank you.
Yeah, no, my pleasure. And, you know, I love that it's called Seven Spoons, because not just because, you know, it references your blog and the voice that people have learned to love and get to know, but also it's almost sort of metaphoric, too, of everyday eating. So one spoon for every day of the week kind of thing. And so I think it works really well.
Oh, I love that. I haven't heard that before. This is actually a very funny story. It was when my first son was born. We used a picture of a spoon on the site because I wanted to announce that I had him. And then with my second son, it was a family of 3 spoons, and then it was 4 spoons. And then someone thought I was going to have like 4 children, that it was going to, or 5 children, or 7 children. Because the 7 spoons was a number that has appeared many times in my life, and mm-hmm. I picked it as a bit of a whim, and I don't know, I might have put more thought into it if I knew I'd be still talking about it 10 years on, yeah. But it was a personal promise to myself, honestly. I was reading a magazine, and I was sitting there in my little dinky apartment with my boyfriend and said, I love my job, but and I was reading this editorial, and the person in it, who admittedly had a life that I wouldn't mind and a job I wouldn't mind having, I said, mm-hmm. I don't need what she's doing, but But she just said that she's 7 years older than I am right now. In 7 years from right now, I want to be doing something I love. I want to be doing something that makes me feel fulfilled. And so in a very selfish way, I put the 7 in the title of the blog as a personal promise and a goal that I would be doing something like that within 7 years. And then Spoons just sounded really good with it. And so that's where that came from. And it makes me feel a little bit sheepish now to admit, but it ended up, you know, making all the difference in the world. So I kind of love it.
Oh, of course. And you should, because when things come from that real, genuine place, it's just a good place. it can't help but being good, right? Because it came from deep within you. And so it spoke to you and therefore you believe in it.
Well, now I'm going to say it's a spoon for every day because that goes so well with the subheading and it makes it sound like it was all so intentional rather than me after work sitting in a magazine and giving myself a goal.
Yeah, no, it sounds perfectly intentional. Well, Tara, thank you. Oh, my goodness. Thank you so very much for coming on. I've really, really enjoyed talking with you. And I know our listeners are going to dive right in and really soak all of this up. So thanks for taking the time.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
So that concludes my talk with Tara. Please share this episode with anyone you know who would be interested in learning a little more about Tara and her approach to cooking. And be sure to pick up a copy of her book so that you can make those cookies too. I figure 700 test cookies must have yielded something pretty spectacular, so I'm going to try it out for myself, possibly even tonight. As always, we've prepared show notes for you over at puregreenmag.com/podcast/Tara-O'Brady. If you feel inspired, please leave a review over on iTunes for us. I've been loving seeing more and more pop up. It's really helpful to help the show grow and know how truly grateful I am that you were able to take 5 minutes to leave that review for me. Also, if you'd like to strike up a conversation with us about this episode, you can do that over on Facebook at facebook.com/puregreenmag. Follow Tara on her blog at sevenspoons.net and on Instagram at Tara O'Brady. That's it for this week. Thank you for listening. I'm Celine McKay, and you're listening to the Pure Green Podcast.